And we're having a public hearing, possible work session on the following bills. Senate Bill 297, relating to low-income telephone assistance. House Bill 2576, relating to unauthorized change in customer telecommunication sources. And Senate Bill 1296, relating to remote-controlled water ski boats. To accommodate some of the witnesses, we are going to move first to House Bill 2576. Senator Blackson, would you like to explain what the bill does and does not do?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2576 prohibits telecommunications utilities and competitive telecommunications providers from billing a customer for a service provided but not expressly requested by a customer, and you probably know this is an activity known as slamming, so this is an anti-slamming bill. This bill also prohibits telecommunications utilities and providers from switching a subscriber's local exchange telecommunications service provider without the subscriber's verified consent, and it also imposes penalties for violation of these provisions. And I've passed out for you the staff measure summaries from both the House Committee on Commerce and the Senate Committee on Rules and Elections, and also a fiscal impact statement from our office. And on Monday, when you heard the budget for the PUC, you made an adjustment to their budget to accommodate this fiscal impact, but we unscheduled it pending passage of the bill signing into law by the governor.
Okay. Are there any questions of Ms. McGlashan before we start hearing on the bill? We'll open the hearing on House Bill 2576. Do we have a sign up for it? There's no one who wishes to sign up and speak on behalf of the bill? Yes, Rick.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Willis with the PUC. With me this morning is Pete Shepard from the Department of Justice, and he's been taking the lead on this bill. So I will turn it over to him to do a short presentation, kind of what the bill does.
Welcome, Pete.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks very much, and I appreciate accommodating my schedule. I'm due in the Senate Judiciary Committee also. I actually appreciate Rick's suggestion that the Department of Justice took the lead on this, but actually it comes to you after an extensive amount of work with the industry as well. And I can tell you that I believe there is no opposition to the bill and indeed support for it. We've received some 1,300 complaints from Oregon consumers about unauthorized switches in their telephone service. The businesses as well are the victims of slamming activity. This is a computer printout of the complaints that have come into our office in the last, the period ending February 18th, and we continue to get slamming complaints in our office. We've done over a dozen enforcement actions under the existing law in the last 18 months, and we have a number of other cases still under investigation. The bill as it comes before you is the result of an extensive working group passed out of the House after two hearings in the subcommittee, Commerce Subcommittee, chaired by Representative Witt. There was no opposition there. I believe it received 56 affirmative votes in the House. Went to the Senate, and Senator Nelson's committee conducted a hearing, and again, there was no opposition in that form, and then it comes to you. Basically, the core of the bill is in Section 2, and it provides that a person's telephone service cannot be changed without that person's separate, affirmative, unambiguous, and verified order to change their service. And that's the simplest way of describing what it is that this bill does. It makes very clear what the obligation of a company that wants to sign up a new customer may be, and then provides remedies for failure to adhere to that obligation.
Pete, this has the net effect of prohibiting slamming of your telephone service, but how is the public supposed to receive the word on it? Is that something that you're going to require as an insert to billing statement, or is this something that Jan Margosian through Consumer Business Services would notify the public of what their rights are? Who sets up the mechanism to inform the public?
Chair, members of the committee, the bill itself does not speak to the consumer education part of this, but I would anticipate two things would occur. First, we've enjoyed a good partnership with the Public Utility Commission under existing law to deal with slamming complaints, and I would anticipate that we would continue to work with them both on the enforcement end and on whatever can be done to alert the public to the to their rights under this bill. Second, I think companies themselves have an interest in not having their customers swiped by a competitor. And so I think we may well find that the industry itself has an interest in making sure that consumers are aware of their rights and remedies. And so I think there is an opportunity here to work with the industry itself, perhaps in the form of inserts in telephone bills or perhaps in materials printed in telephone directories, a variety of other ways that one can imagine we might form some partnerships with the industry on this issue. And I think they'd be motivated to do that.
Okay. Rick, is it your understanding that you might require something of PUC to go as a notification to the public? In support of the concept of the bill, but what troubles me is that we're kind of like shutting the door after the fact. How can we get the word out beforehand so that people are entitled to know what their rights and responsibilities are to keep from having to go to the PUC to sort out after the fact?
Mr. Chairman of the committee, we do plan to put together a campaign, if you will, to notify the public. We will develop brochures and send out, as well as Pete mentioned, working with utilities, the telephone companies, to help get the word out to their sources. So I hear you, Mr. Chair. We do plan on working on getting the word out in a variety of ways.
Representative Patrick. Mr. Shepard, I just have two questions on the bill that I'm going to look at a little bit. One, I was looking at Section 2 in regards to long-distance I guess my concern is Section 2, little A, that is lines 12, 13, 14, page 1. I had question 1 about why this is in there. Sure, it's going to affect some of the wireless people are also offering, you know, they bundle long distance with their package, and then not seeing, I guess, the rest of the section, just going to affect wireless, and they're giving away free cell phones and stuff like that. And secondly, in terms of, like, for example, U.S. West or DG or whatever, who does some of, I believe, skill for some of these long-distance companies, what's going to happen with them in terms of if they get messages from these long-distance providers that they're going to do this, is this going to create some kind of onerous or more paperwork burden on them that's going to cause some kind of rate shock to the ratepayers when we do this? Because they're going to, I think, the way I read it, they're going to be subject to these penalties too if they don't have strong verification. I'm just wondering, you know, from an industry perspective, I know you had everyone at the table, but what's the effect going to be? What's the effect going to be on our consumers from a rate shock standpoint?
Chair, Representative Patridge, with respect to your first question, I don't believe it would affect this provision, line 12 to 14, would affect promotions involving a free buy one, get one free, or sign up with us and get a free phone kind of promotion. That's not the award of a prize. I would not think a reasonable construction would do that. The reason that provision is in here is that one of the common ways in which we've seen consumers slam is through the use of a sweepstakes entry card. Typically, if the fair, one of the cases we've done involved cards distributed at the fair, And the card was next to a shiny red car, and it said, sign up for the sweepstakes and win the shiny red car. Consumers who entered the sweepstakes found that what they had really done was agree on the backside of that card in very tiny type that we call mice type in our office, to switch their service from provider A to provider B. Well, there's no sense in which that was, in fact, an affirmative, unambiguous order for a switch in service, and yet the company, of course, asserted that these consumers, they had, after all, in their documents, a document that said the consumer had agreed to switch. So the straightforward way to deal with that scam is to say you can't simultaneously promote a sweepstakes or an award of a prize and obtain the consumer's authorization to switch from A to B. Now, on your second question, Representative Petridge, I think I'm not the right person to answer that. I think perhaps one of the industry people could better address the question of whether this would have an effect on rates. I can tell you that we turned this thing inside out with a whole spectrum of industry representatives, and that was not a concern that they raised. But I wouldn't presume to speak for them on that question.
Okay. Further questions, Senator Lim.
And Ms. Nunesbaum, Information Education, how about the planning capital in case you buy the live provider telephone long distance AT&T and also they are providing me the local water thing, then how can other companies take my telephone to there? How does that happen?
Chair, Senator Lim, one way that it would happen is with the sweepstakes promotion card that I just described. The most common way that it happens, however, is in connection with a telephone telemarketing campaign. So you may, in one case that we received, we worked on, consumers reported that they had received a telephone call from a telemarketer who said, asserted that they were conducting a survey of customer satisfaction with their current long-distance service. The caller reported that they were conducting a survey and asked a series of questions of the consumer. Do you like your long-distance service? Yes, I do. Is it of good quality? Yes, I do. Are the connections made properly with your present service? Yes, it is. If you could get that same quality service at a lower price, would you want to do that? Well, of course I would want to do that. Well, that then was taken by that telemarketing firm that was working on behalf of a rival company as that consumer's agreement to change to a different company, because they said, after all, the consumer said they wanted to get the same service, and they will. It'll still be delivered over the same telephone lines and mechanically and electronically still processed in the same way. And it perhaps would be a little less money for some kinds of service. And yet that consumer did not affirmatively and unambiguously agree to change service. There are many variations on that kind of theme, but typically it's some kind of confusing presentation that bamboozles the consumer and confuses them to the point where they don't really recognize what they're doing.
Okay, follow-up question.
Yes.
In case if other companies slam my telephone line, do I have a right to not to pay that amount? And how do I distinguish that amount?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lim, that is one of the improvements that the bill will work. And it is in Section 1 of the bill. The response to your question is in Section 1. And what the bill provides in Section 1 is that if you have been the victim of a slam, that you are excused from any payment to that company, to the slammer, for the first 30 days of service that slammer purports to deliver service to you. And typically, consumers don't discover that they've been the victim of a scam until after they receive their next month's bill. So the thought of the Section 1 of this bill is to hold consumers harmless for that period of time, at least that period of time.
Okay. Curious.
Can a long-distance telephone company drop you if you don't use their service? We reached a point where everybody was supposed to make a choice for a long-distance company. And so I chose the company that I had been with. They were fine. And a couple of years later, I actually paid attention to the numbers and the cost and all of it, and had been using one of the other, you know, the dial the numbers before you make it. And I've been doing that for about a year. And my son came home from college not familiar with that, tried to take a long-distance call and said, "Mom, we don't have a long-distance cell phone company." I said, "You're kidding." I assumed I still had the original provider, so you could dial one in the area code and that. And,
Mr. Chair,
I don't have any other numbers. I'm in good shape.
Senator Dukes, I the bill doesn't speak to that, and I think perhaps the Public Utility Commission staff has a better answer than I would.
Yeah, and I'll ask.
But it's a reverse of slamming.
I'll ask Reed Harris from our staff to come up and specifically answer your question.
Welcome. Would you identify yourself, please?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, I'm Reed Harris, Program Manager of the Consumer Services Section of the Public Utility Commission. Mr. Chairman, Senator Dukes, I guess the answer to your question is no, they are not obligated necessarily to keep you as a customer. The long-distance market has become competitive, and once that is competitive, some of the players have elected not to serve in certain areas. Some of them have the idea being that it's no longer monopoly type service. I assume you're talking about the local long distance. It may be the long distance. Some of the players selected areas where they wanted to participate and not participate in others. There is not a requirement that they do so. It would be courtesy, I would assume, a common courtesy, but there isn't a requirement. It's a competitive marketplace, and a lot of the notifications that went out in bill stuffers are very easy to miss.
Yeah, I have one more follow-up question. It's just Senator Dukes and you say Senator Lim.
Thank you. When they are slamming, could they slam a long distance call or a local long distance call or what situation is happening?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lim, yes, with the expansion of the competitive markets, theoretically, a slammer could take your long distance, your local long distance, and in some areas, as competition moves into local service, they could take your local service as well. Illustration is once they kick the door open, they're not just going to settle for the TV, they're going to get the VCR and the stereo as well.
Okay. And one more question.
Mm-hmm.
If the deal incorporates with the deal I'm getting from the ATMs, they are not sending the separate bill, then how can I find out when it's slammed, which one belongs to them? It's very difficult to distinguish between in the same deal.
Chairman, Senator Lim, depending upon your carrier of choice, you may elect to have separate billing, where it is billed commonly, usually through your local carrier. This is part of what we envision as part of the consumer education program is to educate consumers to read their bills, to look at it. This is another reason why this bill contains a 30-day provision, because the way that most people are going to find out that they've been slammed is by showing up on the bill. There are numbers that you can call, telephone numbers that you can call, which will identify who your carrier is at that given moment. But primarily how people are going to find out is by really looking at the bill and knowing what they're looking at.
Any further questions? Thank you both very much. have Gary Bauer and Bruce Shaw. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gary Bauer with Oregon Telecommunications Association. Just wanted to quickly state that we do appreciate the work that the Justice Department did on this. They sat down and went through a number of changes. Our concern was that we not have a conflict with the federal regulations that have recently been adopted, and that we not, as a result, have differing types of regulations for those companies that operate in multi-state. And I think they've tried to accomplish that in a lot of the language. Another area we had was there actually can be legitimate disagreements over the service and whether or not someone agreed or did not agree, and that there not be a process set up that somebody can automatically just waive 30 days worth of calling. And I think, again, working with the agencies, I think we can probably get around that. And then the other concern we have is that we didn't have both a federal and a state investigation open up on the same issue, because that then requires resources by both the local company and the long-distance company in sorting that out. And when you're trying to do that with two separate agencies that may have separate remedies, again, that was a concern. And again, I think in the legislation, Mr. Shepard tried to address that, and working with the PUC, we think we can work our way through those issues.
Mr. Chair, Bruce Shaw with Sprint. Just want to echo what Gary said and express our appreciation for working with Pete on this particular bill. He did include a number of us, and we hammered out the issues in good fashion, and we're fine with the bill.
Okay, thank you. Representative Patrick.
Let me just respond. We see what the PUC's impact is going to be. Any reaction from the industry on what kind of a threat? I mean, you're just going to absorb it as a nominal, because we're going to have to, it comes out of other funds, so it comes off telephone bills.
Chair, that's St. Patrick, Gary Bauer. I actually have not seen the budget impact for it. I'm not sure how nominal that is. But generally, the PUC, as you know, is funded through fees on the utilities. And regulatory fees are passed on as a cost of doing business.
$228,182.
Mr. Chair, we have to be a fraction of a cent per customer.
A fraction of the cent per customer?
Yep.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Patrick.
I guess my concern, I guess my bigger concern, though, is what's it going to do to all the telecommunications providers? So I think they're going to probably want to be a lot more cautious with larger penalties at least looming out there. So I'm just wondering what kind of effect that's going to have on what they're going to need to do internally, and how that's going to affect rate payers over in the government.
Mr. Chair, Lieutenant Patrick, Bruce Shaw with Sprint. I think basically this is something we deal with every day in terms of Sprint having both local and long distance service, and it is a concern to us. I don't see that it would impact our particular operating costs in any incremental amount, basically, because we do have the problem today and dealing with upset customers and getting them switched back and so forth. And I think, if anything, it may drive our costs down if there are bad actors out there that we can suppress their activity and not get as much, not get as many complaints in this regard.
I was just hoping that's what the industry would say was, we're doing a good job.
It's not going to have any impact on consumers at all.
This is to deal with the bad actors. But,
okay. Good question. And then,
is it for a maximum $5,000 for the company or for each individual they do? I'm sorry. Am I asking the question of the wrong person? Okay, I agree with you, sir.
Pete Shepard, would you come back forward and identify yourself?
with me for just a second. I want to get the exact language. Excuse me, I'm looking at the wrong bill. My judiciary committee.
Line 28 on page 2 starts to impose a civil fine of up to $1,000 for each violation in Section 2 of this Act.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, thank you. Senator Lim, we would interpret that, the phrase each violation to mean each customer.
Customer.
Each customer. And that's how this language in Section 3 is modeled on the existing Unlawful Trade Practices Act, which contains an identical provision except that it has a much larger penalty. And the reason that we felt that $1,000 for each violation was adequate, was an adequate deterrent in the area of slamming, is that if we find one customer who's been slammed, we're certain to find many more. So those penalties will add up in a big hurry and will, we hope, create a deterrent to this kind of practice.
Okay, Mr. Chair, you might be getting $1,000 for penalty, but the question is what we are getting.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lim, first, this cause of action can be brought by a customer as well. If a customer has suffered an ascertainable loss of money or property, for example, if the slammer's fees are higher than the rates that your preferred carrier charge, then you would have suffered an ascertainable loss, and in theory, you could yourself bring an action and recover $1,000. Now, in addition to the damages that you have suffered. This does apply both to actions brought by the Attorney General and to actions brought by individuals.
Thank you.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. And perhaps it's Mr. Willis I need to direct this question to. I think in prior testimony, you were told that the PUC had already maxed its the amount for prison they provided under the statute that is presently able to charge as 1/4 of 1%, 1/4 of 1%, I think, is of the gross. And at some point, there is no request for any increases by the PUC. This is a fee that is presently already maxed out and being charged. Where does the money come from? Do we have, again, another pot of money here that the PUC is sitting on that we don't know about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, no, there's no pot of money that you're not aware of. Our budget is in the area of $30 million. Our collections are somewhat higher than that, and that is that ending balance. If you remember that chart that we put up, we can absorb the $228,000 within the existing fees that we charge.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes. So basically what we're saying is that there is no additional cost that's going to be passed on to the customers in order to provide this service, that it's well within the current scope of all of the charges that are being presently charged through the PUC and passed on to the customers.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, this bill will not cause us to adjust the millage rate.
Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Yee.
Mr. Chairman, does this mean we have to increase the FTE authorization for you so you can hire two more people?
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, yes, I believe the committee approved that on Monday. I'm scheduled the funds and two FTE.
Another question.
Yes.
So if the company is found to be fraudulent in their action in charging unauthorized charges, are you going to bill the company for the time you spend in your investigation? It doesn't seem fair for ratepayers to pay some action that the company took that are fraudulent.
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, we don't bill
company specifically for the time spent on an investigation. No, that is part of the overall millage rate that we charge all companies to support the mission of PUC and the workings of it. We don't have a system set up where we track the exact time of each employee involved in an investigation and charge it to that specific company.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Well, it just doesn't seem fair that if the company go on doing things they're not supposed to do, and the ratepayers have to pay for investigation and all the costs. So there must be a way that PUC should be able to recover those costs. I know you charge them rates in proportion to the workload. But there must be a way that you can tell the company this is not acceptable and they should pay for it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, to the extent that a judicial enforcement action has to be brought or even is threatened in order to stop ongoing misconduct, the bill does provide that the prevailing party in that lawsuit can recover its reasonable attorney's fees. So, to that extent, if, for example, the Public Utility Commission identified a particularly bad actor in the marketplace, came to the Department of Justice and asked us to bring a lawsuit to assist, or we initiated one on our own even, based on the complaints, part of the relief we could get would be to transfer at least the attorney fee part of the cost of that enforcement action to the wrongdoer and away from taxpayers and in the case of PUC, the utilities that provide the money.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
That's not the part I'm talking about. I'm talking about the time you spend in investigating these actions, and that cost should be borne by the company. Because they're paying for two FTEs, even though you can absorb that in your budget, that really is unnecessary expenses if companies do what they are supposed to do. So I hope that you can look into it and see a way to reduce this cost and charge it to the utility companies who are responsible for those actions.
That's a very valid point, and I think what the Senator is saying is a concern that I also have, that the consumers, the people using the telephone service, are subsidizing the bad actors, because it's the customers who are being dinged 0.5% or 1% or whatever the figure is to do the investigation, when that should be a charge against the bad actor rather than the public. Why should the public, that's like saying, go to a hospital and pay the liability insurance for a doctor and believe and take care of the bad doctors. And the patient is then subsidizing the bad doctors. That's the case here where the customer is subsidizing the bad actors rather than having the bad actor be responsible for the investigative costs and any kind of agreement that is issued from it. I think that's what Senator is trying to get at. But I think that's a very valid point. Why should the consumer public have to subsidize somebody who's doing improper activity? Would you be able to recover damages from the... I don't know. It just seems like we're saying let's make the public responsible for something that is being done to them unknowingly or unwittingly. It's being done to them. And we're saying let the public be damned. Make them pay for this good faith housekeeping. Well, it should be the bad actor is paying for it.
Mr. Chair, I hear what you're saying. Currently, our system is set up such that we charge that millage rate, and it goes to cover the entire operation of the PUC, except our CF program. But I hear what you and Senator are saying, and we will take a look at that.
Okay.
You make a good point.
Cindy.
Mr. Chairman, is there any way you can just bill them for the time you take in investigation and say you have done a fraudulent act and you need to be responsible for the staff time in investigation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, potentially there is, and we haven't looked at that, potentially there is. We will take a look at that, and I will get back to both of you and the entire committee on that.
I'd rather see a $5,000 assessment go against a company that is the bad actor than the $5,000 go against spreading it out amongst a whole bunch of telephone customers for the bad action of one. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that once there is a deterrent in the law, floor slamming and cramming and the other things that telephone companies or long distance carriers are reported to be doing, I really question whether or not we are going to need two full-time positions over long durations of time. From an aspect of two different areas. Number one, we've got a stack. He had a stack here just a moment ago saying there were 1,300 complaints. I assume that's over 18 months.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I believe that was the time period that was covered by that.
So that'd be about 3 per working day, and they estimate that it takes 3 hours of staff time to handle each complaint. That's a total of 9 hours, and I appreciate the fact that, that's something over one position, but I guess my concern is that with that particular provision in law that provides for the penalties that we're talking about being imposed, I'm wondering if that isn't sufficient deterrent to keep the bad actors out of the marketplace and whatever kind of a situation we do here, it would be a limited duration because it should start to diminish. And the second question that I have is the obvious, and that is, have you done nothing with these 1,300 complaints?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we've done over a dozen enforcement actions against companies.
Out of the 1,300 complaints?
Based in part on those 1,300
complaints. That's been done with current resources without any additional FTEs. Is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I haven't done an analysis of how much time the Department of Justice has spent on these matters. It's been very substantial. And that's obviously been to the detriment of our other responsibilities. So I don't know how great that investment has been. We've had one Assistant Attorney General on these, I would guesstimate, maybe half or three-quarters time. Doing a lot of work, I might say, that in under this bill, we would benefit greatly from the involvement of the Public Utility Commission staff in collecting the information we need at the front end of these cases and would dramatically reduce the amount of investigative time the Department of Justice has to spend.
Mr. Chair, I represent Butler. Thank you very kindly. I do believe that we did accommodate for the historic usage and anticipated usage in the existing PUC budget, which we have already taken action on, and I believe that that we've got money in there both for the current staff for compliance purposes. I believe that we made an ample allocation for litigation issues, as a matter of fact, so much so that I feel like that we probably are the most litigious agency in the entire state at this particular point. And I think that we have plenty of dough in this particular budget to accommodate these particular issues, and I think once you've got law on the book, I just don't believe that you're going to have the kind of necessary issues that need to be litigated on a regular basis, because I think the bad actors are going to try and stay away from Oregon if they're involved in this kind of illegal activity.
The only question I would have, what happens to the person that calls you from New Jersey in a back room somewhere working for Timbuktu telephone company and they call you a long distance from New Jersey and tell you about the good deals their phone operator provides. Do you have any jurisdiction over that person?
Sure, members of the committee, we this law and the existing Unlawful Trade Practices Act do allow us to pursue out-of-state wrongdoers who inject themselves into our marketplace.
Most of the bad actors are occurring outside the state or inside the state.
Sure, most of the cases I've seen have originated from out of state.
So you feel there's adequate safeguard and protection for you to take corrective action against these out-of-state bad actors?
Sure, from a jurisdictional standpoint, this bill does as much as we can do under Oregon law to reach out-of-state markers.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think we can do
that. Well, I heard your comment about bad actors are going to stay away from Oregon. They're not in Oregon. They're outside of Oregon calling into Oregon.
But, Mr. Chair, if I could respond to that, if they're trying to sell for Sprint or if they're trying to sell for someone else and there's a case that comes up that people say is a slamming issue, Sprint has nexus with Oregon. All of the companies that are able to charge on the utility bills presently have some kind of nexus with Oregon or they couldn't be charging. You wouldn't be allowing them to provide the service in Oregon. That's how you collect your fee. Is off of the services they provide. And so if there are bad actors selling for an XYZ telephone company that buys a bundled group of services out of New Jersey or nationwide and sells them out of New Jersey, the issue is, you know, they just keep them out of the Oregon market. Well, again, my position is that we have amply funded and there's been no indication that we have not been able to handle all 13 or whatever it is of the cases that have actually gone to court within the current budget constraints which we have provided for the PUC and providing additional for AG and those kinds of things would be compounding it.
Okay. Ms. McGlashan, you have a comment you want to make?
I would, Mr. Chair, and maybe the PUC can expand upon this, but it's my understanding that currently all they do is log complaints that come in. They don't investigate them. So the additional staff is for additional work that would be done for investigating those complaints. If you look at the salary range of those staff, they're at, I believe, a 19. That's a lot lower than staff at DOJ.
Mm-hmm.
So there would be some savings there by having the PUC do the staff.
Mr. Chair, if I can expand on that, Ms. McGlashan is absolutely correct. The investigative time that people are talking about, we're not talking about just the true FTE that we're talking about, are at PUC, to then take over that work and deal with those slamming issues and handle those investigations and hearings if necessary.
Okay. Further questions?
Mr. Chair, I need to correct a misstatement I gave to Senator Lynn in connection with the penalties. It was pointed out by one of my colleagues from the company. The penalty that's recoverable in a private, in the case of you being slammed as an individual consumer, is your actual damages are $200, whichever is greater. That's the remedy for the individual consumer, not the $1,000, which does, in fact, go to the government.
It's going to go up just $200.
Mr. Chair,
very difficult to the amount going to court in time.
Mr. Chair, Senator Lynn, that is a small amount that does provide, in addition, for punitive damages in the event that the consumer demonstrates that there has been a widespread pattern. We would modeled Section 3 on the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, where the limit is the same, $200. And the Department of Justice has proposed several times to increase the penalties under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, unfortunately without success, for the very reason you identify. Our recommendation, however, would be it's probably sensible to keep these provisions consistent with the existing Unlawful Trade Practices Act and leave for another day the general policy question of whether that $200 should be increased to a greater amount.
Yes.
the national amount, $5,000. So I try to read where that's coming from. Not less than 500, but not more than $5,000.
I read that one in the set major comment. I'm not sure where that's coming from.
Well, Senator Lynn, I think I can clear that up.
I think it was deleted.
That's correct. I think the staff measure summary probably wasn't amended for that. But that, if you look at
but
the
that section was deleted.
Was deleted.
Yeah. Yes.
Why that was deleted?
Chair Senator Lim, I honestly don't recall at what stage of the process that was deleted. I think that was in the bill as originally introduced, and the entire measure is different now than the format in which it was originally introduced.
Okay. Further questions? Senator Yates.
Chairman, I raised a question about billing the companies that plan to have fraudulent action for the staff time each day. Maybe we should do that and add assessment, a fine for doing it. Is it something you can do and let us know before the bill is heard in the full committee?
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, we'd have to go back and get with the group, the working group, Jerry Bauer and his folks, and have a discussion about that. I don't know if there is enough time to put all that together.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know.
Because you understand the question is, why should everybody pay for one company's action that's not acceptable? Besides, if we charge them and add a fine or an assessment, that really would be a deterrent in preventing things from happening again. Hopefully the 1,300 complaints will go down to zero, we hope, and not have to have the two FTEs to keep investigating.
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, I'm certainly willing to visit with the PUC and with the industry to see if there's something that can be done along those lines. We do run against the problem that we have in all areas of consumer enforcement, which is that the imposition of a, we recognize that the imposition of a penalty on a business probably results in that business spreading that cost over other consumers. As a realistic matter, that's the likely outcome in any event. And so it's difficult for us, I think it will be difficult to craft any kind of penalty that will cause that buck to stop in the pocket of the person who has violated the rules. That's, I'm willing to try, but I think that's the difficulty. If that's where the legislation wants us to go, that's going to be hard for us to accomplish.
Yes.
Does PUC have authority to regulate rates so that companies are not allowed to increase rates because of the fines and charges they have to pay because of fraudulent actions? Do you have that authority?
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, we do regulate rates. As Mr. Shepherd stated, most of these are out-of-state companies that are doing the slamming. So on those companies, no, we have no jurisdiction over their rates because they're out-of-state companies. One of them's in the Bahamas, I think, or Jamaica or some odd place. So, no, we wouldn't have any jurisdiction over them at all.
But if we have no jurisdiction over them, why do we have a bill to stop them from fraudulent actions?
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, I'm talking about the jurisdiction that you raised, which is of controlling the rates. This bill addresses a different issue, which is not basic phone rates, but slamming issue. And there we can have some jurisdiction.
But you can notify, Mr. Chairman,
mm-hmm.
You can notify the proper authority and tell them that they have committed actions that are not acceptable, and if their authority, the responsible authority, wanted to allow them to increase rates, then that's their responsibility. But I think it's our job to tell them that the company under their jurisdiction have committed actions that's not acceptable, and we recommend not to allow them to increase rates. we should at least have that authority to communicate our concerns and frustrations.
And I think what the Senator said was, between this subcommittee and the full committee, we would like to have you bring some information to show how the cost is going to be borne by the carrier rather than the public, and spreading that cost around to the public for enforcement of activity that is, like in Ashland, I'm on U.S. West. Why should I pay a cent and a half a month? It may not seem very much, but a cent and a half here and a cent and a half there, pretty soon you're talking real money. And why should all of my customers in U.S. West jurisdictions subsidize somebody else for a bad actor? That's my problem with what we're trying to do here. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make sure that I understood exactly what Mr. Willis said, that these companies that are outside of the state of Oregon, we don't control them. We don't in any way collect any income tax when they do business in the state of Oregon. We don't collect the 0.25% or 1% service fee that the PUC operates off of. I need to make sure that that's actually what you're saying, that these folks can operate offshore and avoid Oregon State income tax on bills that customers are paying from the state of Oregon. Is that exactly what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I never mentioned income tax. I have no idea. That question should probably be directed to the Department of
Revenue. I'm asking you with regard to the PUC fee.
Okay, PUC fee is not related to income tax. The PUC fee is not assessed on offshore companies. No, sir.
So these folks are presently providing service to customers in the state of Oregon, and they're doing business in the state of Oregon, and they're charging and sending bills to people in the state of Oregon, and the PUC is not receiving its share of the, which is charged to every other one of the utility companies in this room. The PUC does not collect one dime from those folks?
Chair Representative Butler, currently we do not. Last session and this session, we introduced bills to change how that rate, how that millage is applied to utilities. And I think there is a bill currently in committee, I'm not quite sure where it is, that addresses that very issue. But currently, right now, that is correct. We do not collect any millage rate from offshore companies. That's correct.
Mr. Chair, I am absolutely aghast. The millions of dollars that this agency spends for all of these various things, and that we have no way of collecting that fee for the use of these services within the state of Oregon. And now we come back to your constituents who are paying for that entire...
That's what Senator E was trying to raise, is that we're subsidizing these people to come in from out of state and screw our citizens.
And we're losing income tax dollars in the process, Mr. Chair, because it's my understanding this money is being collected by the local companies or whomever, and is being sent out of state because we have determined they have absolutely no nexus to the state of Oregon other than the fact that we may be paying millions and millions of dollars a month to these companies in net profits.
Okay. Is there further discussion? If not, thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2576, and I don't think we have the necessary votes to move the bill today, so we're going to carry it over. Pardon me? Tuesday of next week. Okay. Senate Bill 297, we'll open the hearing and possible work session relating to low-income cell phone assistance. Might indicate, too, for the members at 9:30, the co-chairs have indicated they have scheduled Senate Bill 947 dealing with lottery advertising up for a hearing and work session in this committee. So they met the one-hour requirement and posted the notice outside, and we'll be dealing with that bill at 9:30 today. Okay. Senate Bill 297, Ms. McGlashan.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 297 revises the eligibility criteria for the Oregon Telephone Assistance Program that's administered by the PUC. And I've, again, distributed staff member summaries, one from the Senate Committee on Business and Consumer Affairs, and one from the House Committee on Commerce, as well as a fiscal impact statement from the Legislative Fiscal Office. Again, this bill you've accommodated in the Public Utilities Commission's budget that the expenditure limitation is on schedule pending passage of the bill and signed into law by the governor.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Passage.
Hey, Mr. Chair. My concern is in looking at the staff measure summary and continuing to have concerns about the Public Utility Commission. I'm interested to know how much money is available. They say they can absorb these costs. What is it? How much have they been collecting for these OTAP funds, and what's their current, how much money they have in there currently?
Ms. Willis, could you come back
to the webinar?
Chairman, my name is Rick Willis. With me is Vicki McLean. She is our Administrator for Extension Services, which includes the RFPF program. And we can respond to your question.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Passage. The $210,000 is to request limitation as described in the bill. The second question, if that answers your first question, is limitation. The funds, as I mentioned in the memo that I wrote, are collected from the ratepayers, and as we continue to calculate based upon a projection. If we need additional funds, we do collect from them. We raise and lower the rates accordingly. At this time, our ending balance, I'll just look it up in a moment as I pull out that memo. At the end of 1998, the ending balance was about $3.7 million. It is dropping at this time because we are spending down an excess amount of funds that we did have, and it's on its way to 2.8 and then 2.58. And by that, I mean as we collect less, in order to run the program, it takes from that ending balance. Mr. Chair, Representative Patrick, should that answer your question, or have I left?
When does it stabilize, then? I mean, when does the rate?
The rate will stabilize, Mr. Chair, Representative Patrick, at the point that we reach a six-month ending balance, which we expect to be within a year. The law provides for us to have a six-month ending balance. That is our goal, to maintain it at that point. In recent history, the costs have been dropping pretty dramatically as the revenue collections have been increasing, and as a result, we've had to continue to drop that rate and keep it below our costs. At the point we reach the 6.6 month ending balance, then we will, in fact, raise the rate to the point of the cost of the operation that we're there. Now, will that stay at the same number forever? Probably not, because the costs will fluctuate either up or down depending upon what's going on in the program.
Yes.
Quick statement on this. I kind of think this program is a little bit disingenuous if we're paying people $3.50 a month to assist them in telephone assistance programs. The raising the federal poverty level from 135, it looks like, to about 170. You know, frankly, I'd rather see us provide more money for those who are impoverished at the lower end. I mean, $3.50 a month, to me isn't a lot. I know it is a lot to people who are at or below the federal poverty level, but it seems like instead of raising the amount of people that are eligible, it seems like we might see more public benefit by raising the amount of money that's available to those individuals who are already on the program, who are in a worse situation than opening up the eligibility. When we open up the eligibility too, we're also looking at raising our fees at some point. This is going to have an impact on fees on everyone else, too. But if we're going to do it, I'd rather help those people who are the most impoverished rather than opening up the program. I think it's kind of funny that we're looking at the Oregon Health Plan, and there's been a lot of talk about shrinking back and the amount of eligible people in order to keep those who are in the most dire need of necessary services on the program, where this program, we're expanding out and not even providing really anything of much substance, I don't think.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, may I respond to that?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Patrick, $3 is the difference of the Oregon contribution. Federal government will contribute $3.50. Let me start over. The total reduction in the phone bill is $10.50. The remainder of that is contributed by the federal government, some of which is matched to ours. $10.50 covers the majority of the basic rate of an individual. The second question that, or issue that you raised is 170%. There are very, very few programs in adult and family services that are rising to 170%. And what happens to those folks that are in those programs for pregnant women and dependent children, although I'm not versed on exactly what those programs are because they're not ours, is that the majority of them do have income below 135% of the poverty level, but if the definition of the program changes and picks up some additional people, those very, very poor individuals who've been receiving OCAT benefits now drop from the program, even though they have as great a need as they ever did. And what we were trying to avoid is two things, being different than the Department of Human Resources and dropping very needy people from our program.
I guess you just highlighted something that I have a strong concern about ever since this program has been in effect. You talked about $350 from the state and then $350 matched from the federal government, like it's some kind of manna from heaven. And it's one and the same taxpayer. And I have always felt that having a telephone is a privilege, not a right. And all of a sudden, we're trying to treat telephone service as a basic right of individuals. And I really have a difficult time with telling my low-income people who are working, who are paying taxes, who do not get this subsidy, you pay more for taxes so we can redistribute your wealth to other people. And that's my concern with this. And opening it up to even more individuals causes me even greater gastric distress on this. So that's where I'm coming from. Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that one reason would be just so we wouldn't drop people off this program, but it seems to me this is an expansion of the program. Can you just give a little bit better explanation of why people would be dropped off?
The way the current law is written, it describes eligibility for our program as being on a public assistance program for which the definition is 135% of or less of poverty level. So if a program at Department of Human Resources is currently defined at 135% or less of poverty level, people can come to our program and benefit from that program. If a small slice of those programs, as in this case, suddenly the definition is 170%, it does in fact, as you say, pick up a few individuals, but by the sheer definition of it, drops all those below
135%. It's the, Mr. Chair, if you're below 170%, I'd better probably write you less than that, just below 135%.
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, when you define a program as people who are eligible for it at 170% or less of federal poverty level, and our law says every person who's eligible for our program has to be on a program for whose eligibility standards are 135% or less, by definition, everyone who falls in that category, 170% or less, falls off the program because they are in that program, even though their income may be below 135%.
Okay. Further questions? Senator Yee.
Question. What is the 100% poverty level now? for, say, a family of three?
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, I don't have the exact figures. And the entire eligibility process is determined at Adult and Family Services. The last time I looked at those figures, a family of one was approximately $800, but I would be real reluctant to put that as fact because of the fact they do determine the eligibility standards, and we do not.
Yes.
So 130% poverty level will increase 805%, so you're talking about 1,040. So at 170%, would be about 1,360 if you add 7% of 800. So you're just increasing the income level. So you're helping the people who are less poor by expanding the program. Instead of helping the people who are really needy, you're helping people who are less needy. You're expanding the clients to include the less needy people at the expense of regular clients. And this is not even a optional contribution. This is a forced contribution. We are forcing the increase in surcharge to help the less needy population. Correct.
Mr. Chair, Senator Yee, I would be reluctant to use the numbers that you use, but to a degree...
I just quoted in your numbers.
Yeah, but I'm not comfortable with those numbers because I don't determine eligibility, and therefore I don't know what they are. However, you are correct that for the small group of clients, there are 2,000 that may be coming our direction, they will be receiving a slightly higher income than those in the past and be on our program when they had not been on the program in the past. That is a true statement.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Well, first of all, I'd like you to give us a chart of the 100% poverty, 130%, 170% of those income. But I've been concerned with this program ever since it started. Because one, utility companies are here to provide the best service at the least cost. And here we are providing service with forced increase in cost. And secondly, it's not even democratic. It's a surcharge that you cannot avoid. You may want to contribute towards schools or parks, but you have to contribute to the less needy people now, determined by the Utility Commission regulation. And I think it's against the purpose of their existence is to help provide the best service at the most efficient level. And thirdly, we are increasing costs when the cost has already gone up enough. The contract for relay service is increased by about 40 to 50% this biennium from 83 cents to $1.26 cents per minute. So it's a 40 or 50% increase. And then their cost has gone from 1987, 10 years ago, from 2.2 million to 6.7 million. Three times that much in 10 years. And we have a budget note to say, please be efficient and try to contain costs so we don't have to force these charges to ratepayers. And here comes the commission have this recommendation. It's beyond my belief that they would want to do this. So I'm very concerned with this proposal.
Okay, thank you. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, before we close the public hearing on this, I just wanted you to know that, number one, I think we probably have a lady in the room who knows something about the various levels of the Department of Human Resources, the poverty level, and that and Senator Keita. And number two, I'd have to declare at the 170% of the poverty level, I'd have to declare a potential conflict of interest if I could be a participant in this program. Thank you.
All 90 legislators probably said. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 297 and open the public work session on Senate Bill 297. Senator Keita.
Well, I was just going to say it. I can't believe that somebody's before this committee in testimony and doesn't know the level of poverty. Whether it's decided in another division or something, you have to be able to figure out what the level of poverty is in order to figure out how many people are going to belong to it and therefore come up with a fiscal impact of it. So to sort of declare, well, I don't know, and while that may be, yeah, I mean, it may change, and it does change on a yearly basis, but we ought to have some inkling of what it actually is in the testimony before, so that we can make a decent decision.
Okay. So to help move the bill along, I'm going to make a motion to table it. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? If not, it's so ordered. Ms. Willis, I would suggest that you have some homework to do with members of the committee. Okay? Let me ask a consensus of the committee on Health Bill 2576. So we had a public hearing on this morning. We didn't have enough votes to deal with it. We didn't have a quorum. Is it the consensus of the committee that you'd like to go back and revisit House Bill 2576, the anti-slamming bill? Senator Lamb.
This is the House Bill 2576, this looks like a paper tiger. It doesn't do anything. It's a company out of the state. I'm not sure what we can do with this bill. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't help anybody.
Okay. Are there any comments from the House, Representative Butler?
Mr. Chair, I'm absolutely flabbergasted with the fact that the attitude of we do business with these companies and, from out of state and that potentially are doing large volumes of business, and the legitimate companies who have nexus to the state of Oregon, who have offices here, not only pay the full price for the PUC service that is charged under statute to these various providers and companies, but they also pay income tax to the state of Oregon. And the pathetic attitude is, oh, these folks use these lines and they do it with impunity, and we're not going to do anything about it. And until that attitude changes, I just have to say that I don't have any inkling of putting more money into the PUC, supplementing their AG fees that we've already increased twofold, so that they can continue with other lawsuits that I'm not in agreement with.
Is there further discussion?
In public hearing or
in public work session. You want to ask a question now, or we can open it up?
No, I'm just trying to get into the meeting on this stuff.
Okay, Representative Schrader.
I like this bill. How
about that? Give him a hug. Okay. Is there further discussion? Does the committee want to revisit this bill or not?
Mr. Chair, I like the bill, but I need to work on it, make sure it's going to work.
Okay.
I want to make sure that the company, currently, because of AT&T, is locally responsible. They should be responsible.
Okay.
And the bottom, I don't see that in here.
What I'm going to ask, Senator Lim, is if you and LFO staff and PUC and the telephone companies were to get together and work out language that you're comfortable with, because we'd like to move this, but we need the committee support to do so, or else we can't move it out of committee.
I would do.
So if you'd be some time to serve as a committee or one, or if you need some other person to help you, that's also fine.
Okay. Any volunteers?
Any volunteers on the outside?
I like Senator
Lamb. Okay. Representative Patrick will help you. All right. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2576. And in 7 minutes, we're having a public hearing. The work session on Senate Bill 947 is announced earlier in the meeting. Until then, we have Senate Bill 1296 relating to remote control water ski boats. Ms. George.
Chair, members of the committee, I've sent at your seats a copy of the staff member summary from the spokesperson committee on Senate Bill 1296, which is relating to the remote controlled water ski boats. And on the back of that is the fiscal impact statement. The measure was referred down to Ways and Means to consider any fiscal impact that might be a result of this policy decision by the legislature. The fiscal office has acknowledged that the Marine Board estimates an fiscal impact of $127,287 and half an FTE for the work that they would have to do to develop administrative rules, update their brochures, develop safety policies relating to the use of these devices. The agency identified general fund as the source for this increase. LFO believes that that can come out of and should come out of the agency's other fund resources, as it does for the regulation of other watercraft, and not general fund.
All right, thank you. I noticed in your explanation here, LFO believes that the amount of money indicated by $127,287 may be excessive, and that the actual fiscal impact would be somewhat less. And it goes on to state, for instance, that it would not be necessary to designate a zone in each county of the state, and the board should establish a few zones initially until the number of these crafts warrant increasing the area they could operate. Is it your belief then that the fiscal impact can in fact be substantially lower?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, LFO believes that it would be somewhat less. There isn't anything in this legislation that requires them to develop a large-scale program, and prudence would tell us that you wouldn't want to start it out that way anyway. The amount of rulemaking and investigation would be the same, but the amount of setting zones in every water area in the state would not, and that would substantially lower the cost.
Okay. Are there further questions of staff? We'll open the hearing on Senate Bill 1296. Mr. Hughes, would you like to come forward, please? And let me indicate to you, at about 9:30, we are scheduled for a public hearing, a work session on Senate Bill 947, so I would ask you to keep your comments very brief.
Mr. Chairman, good morning. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Ted Hughes, representing this morning the Ski Free Corporation, headquartered in Bellevue, Washington. Ski Free has come up with a new technology, something that is not on the waterways of any of our states. It was invented 10 years ago. The corporation was a Canadian company and never made it. The man on my right, Robert Spells, was involved with that Canadian company. And 10 years ago, for his settlement, he got the patent and some substantial money. And now, in the last 2 years, he has been hiring Boeing engineers and making this a safe product, as I'm sure he'll be able to tell you. The craft is eligible to be used in 40 states. Our surrounding states, California and Washington, both permit it. And the amazing thing to me that I just heard a moment ago was the legislative fiscal. I believe we had this bill in Senate Transportation. The Marine Board at that time said there was no fiscal impact. I don't know where that all of a sudden that has changed. There shouldn't be a fiscal impact, in my opinion. To my right is Robin Sells, the founder and CEO of Ski Free, and he is here to tell you a little bit about the product and its inception and why we're here asking your permission to make this, I guess, legal. There isn't going to be a great number of these on the waterways for 2 or 3 or 4 years, the way I see it anyway. They are now in production. You'll notice a couple other things I want to say on line 22 and 23. However, every such boat shall comply with all other applicable provisions of this chapter. We're not asking for any special treatment for any kind of watercraft. So, without any more from me, I'd like to introduce Mr. Robinson.
Okay, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. opportunity to address you. Simply put, without passage of this bill, we will not be able to do business in the state of Oregon. The state of Oregon is a very important state for us to be able to sell our watercraft in. Currently, right now, as of the 1997 registrations, Oregon rates number 24 in the United States with 197,000 boat registrations. I do find it interesting, the number one state, Michigan, at 957,000, number two being California with almost 895,000 registrations, number three, Florida, with 796,000, number four state, Minnesota, 768,000, and where I come from, the state of Washington, number 19 in the United States with 245,000, almost 246,000 registrations. Each of those particular states has passed similar legislation to make a provision for us to be able to sell our watercrafts in. The only thing that is really different about our watercraft is that the craft in itself is, while it would fall under a classification as a jet ski, it's under 16 feet in length and is classified as a Class A motorboat, there is no provision for a rider or an operator on board. The unit is a water skier operated tow craft. It's a personal ski machine that the skier operates remotely from the ski handle. Some of the things that we have built into this particular unit over the last couple of years in making it a very safe unit, we have a very unique tri-hull that has been designed for greatly improved tracking stability. We have an automatic down skier flag so that when the skier falls, the flag automatically pops up and retracts back in again when the craft is restarted. We have a double engine kill switch built into the electronic handle so that again, when the skier lets go, the craft comes to a dead stop. But as another added precaution, we also have a lanyard type kill switch, which can be overridden for performance and exhibition type of skiing. The deck of the watercraft is a very, very low profile to ensure strong visibility, and with that, we have shortened the conventional tow line from 75 feet behind a regular tow boat to 40 feet. We do have more than sufficient flotation within the craft to support a tired or down skier if it became necessary. We have complied with all the Coast Guard regulations in that regard. Additionally, the engine, much like a jet ski, uses a jet pump rather than an external propeller so that there are no external moving parts to harm somebody. The very nature of this craft ensures that it's going to be used in our marketing study by individuals who have greater experience and knowledge of the boating safety and rules of the water. Additionally, water skiers, as opposed to jet skiers, are looking for flat water. They're not looking for the big lakes to be able to jump this watercraft with, and because of that, anytime our little unit would go over a large wake or wave, the engine cavitates and results in no propulsion whatsoever, so the skier can't be pulled. Our market studies also show that the vast majority of our users will be on the water when other types of watercraft are not. Our craft, as I said, doesn't perform when it jumps out of the water, and in that, we really like to differentiate ourselves against the jet skis. We have very high visibility graphics to ensure that there is strong attention drawn to the craft. And one of the things, back to the 40-foot tow line, is that if an accident were to occur on this, the user is 40 feet away. I've seen many boating and many personal watercraft accidents over the years where the impact on the units was kind of detrimental to some of the individuals there. The last thing that I would really like to bring out here, too, is the potential loss of revenues for the state of Oregon. We have had in the last several months an incredible number of dealer inquiries since our advertising started, and we have projected over the next 2 years a potential loss of revenues for dealers in the state of Oregon close to $7 million. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, I can see that you can see that it's not an unsafe vehicle. It'll be used by experienced water skiers. Those are the ones that are going to want to buy it. It's also unsafe to get up in the morning and drive to the Capitol. And so if you hear these safety arguments, please take them with a grain of salt.
Well, if we see you skating across the water pond on the way to work, we'll know you've arrived. We're going to recess to Senate Bill 1296 and go to the hearing work session on Senate Bill 947. Mr. Lamont? We'll come back to 1296 in just a moment.
Before I do this, some of the last answers that I've had federal poverty level.
Good, now I know where I fit in.
President Butler already declared conflict.
I may qualify before Senator Keith leaves the room. I may qualify for additional benefits here. I've got a 14-year-old daughter as well, so
I got 14.
Okay, we're back to Senate Bill 947, and Ms. Lamont is handing the Senate bill out to the members, and she's going to have some possible recommendations.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have this bill in front of you before for a public hearing. I have distributed to you the recommended amendments that Senator Lim has submitted, and I would defer to him in terms of discussing those amendments.
Okay. Senator Lim, would you like to discuss your proposed amendment?
Mr. Chair, I do appreciate it. Some of the members, including the Ways and Means, were concerned from the existing biennium. I made that the proposed the amendment not affecting this coming biennium. And they consider when we start promotional gambling advertisements, maybe revenue might drop. Of course, that might be a possibility. But they are spending around $5 to $6 million in biennium advertising for the traditional game I'm talking about. The lottery game, which is about the video poker game, total revenue close to 80% of the total that the revenue coming from the lottery, only that the state advertised for 20%. The last since the inception, 1984, the state used close to $60 million for promoting this traditional game. I think it's about time to stop it. And because of the reason that I propose this legislation, including the best two amendments.
Thank you, Senator Lim. Are there any questions of Senator Lim?
Mr. Chair, just to make sure, all we're doing is we're just delaying the effects basically what we can say is that the $22-23 million of loss in the current biennium would go away with your amendment, but that the 35 plus or minus $1 million in the 2001-2003 could potentially would still be there, and then the loss, whatever effect it would be on other revenues of the state.
I don't think it's the $18 million in 1990-01 is going to affect at all, because this bill does not affect this current biennium. But the $28 million, according to the study I have done, it is not that high. I don't know who made this amount. And then our state lottery at this time is stabilized since the inception of Indian, the casino game. tournament. We can name the Indian Games. I don't think it will affect too much stopping promotional gambling advertisements. Most of the 80% of the cost revenue is coming from the video poker, not from the traditional games.
Okay, is there further discussion? If not, I'm going to close the public hearing and go to the public work session on Senate Bill 947. Senator Lim, would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the A2 amendment.
It's on the very last stage of that summation. Senator Lim now moves that the committee adopt the Senate Bill 947-A2 amendments dated 6-11-99 to the Aim Growth Senate Bill 947. Is there a discussion? Is there objection? If not,
Mr. Chairman, I won't object, but I do reserve the right to object to the to vote no on the bill.
Okay. If not, it is passed. Senator Lim?
Chair, I would like to move Senate Bill 947 as amended to the full wage.
Senator Lim now moves Senate Bill 947 to the full wage rules committee as amended with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Senator Yee.
So the impact in 01 to 02 biennium would be $35 million, according to the fiscal impact.
Fiscal amount?
Senator, there are a range of estimates, but we believe that's about the midpoint of the range. Yes, so about $35 million. Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
On the one hand, I can agree with Senator Lim that we shouldn't advertise gambling. But on the other hand, I need to tie the hands of the legislature in 01 to 03. So this is a tough decision.
Mr. Chair, we have to make a tough decision. We will leave gambling alone. That's not the message to the young children. We got enough problems with the league to advertise the gambling.
Well, if we prohibit advertisement for our gambling and the Indian games have no prohibition, they can advertise.
Yes.
So we just lose more of our here to the Indian games. So
advertisement. One is informational advertising is allowed, but a promotional enticing people more into gambling. That is stopping it. So there's plenty of information out there to get it. But I don't believe that this will affect too much. And we need to pick up about $50 million from here for advertisement also. Yeah.
So instead of 35 million impact, it's
exactly
29 million impact.
But I don't believe it's going to affect that much. But if it's going to affect that, maybe it is.
Okay. Further discussion. Senator Lim's motion is to move the bill as amended to the full Ways Committee with a due pass recommendation. Clerk will call the roll, please.
Well, I have a courtesy eye.
Okay, what is that?
Mary?
Aye.
Rex?
No.
Schrader?
No.
Butler?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can I say just a few words?
Well, we're right in the middle of a roll call.
That's
so
why I want to say.
Why you want to say? Well, we're two different things. Hang on here just a second. just want to say just one word. Just one word?
Yeah, just one. Well, maybe one sentence. You may vote no on the floor, but let's have the chance to be there on the floor. That's what I'm asking. This is pretty public at all.
You say
more than one.
Could you move the roll call, Mark?
No.
Not.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye, and the courtesy vote, but the motion fails. Did you see if we could get the co-chair on the House name, please?
You vote.
I would like to ask the courtesy of the committee members to at least pass it to the full committee.
I'll change my vote from aye. I don't know the aye.
You can still vote against it.
Okay. And I won't.
I'll do the same thing. I'll do the same.
Okay. Motion carries. And Senator Lynn, would you carry the bill?
No, we'll do that.
Okay. Is there pardon me?
I need to carry the full committee.
Oh.
Oh, he is not in the phone.
That would be.
Let's see here now. How are we going to do that? I just came up. I'll carry it in front of the full committee. Okay.
And I need a help.
Anybody in the House would like to represent a star? All right. Thank you. All right. We'll close the hearing and work session on Senate Bill 947. And open the hearing on Senate Bill 1296. Paul Don Heffer, would you like to come up forward, please? Welcome to the committee. And I'll let you go.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm here today to hold on to the direction of the Marine Board to address any questions the committee might have regarding the fiscal impact on Senate Bill 1276. We did identify a fiscal impact with this bill after it had a hearing in the Senate Transportation Committee. Once we were able to hear the proponents of the bill describe the need for flat water and no wake zones where the states would operate and got a better feel for it, we felt that indeed there is a need to provide safety zones, not only for the flat wake, but the fact that there is no observer on these craft, and therefore it fundamentally is inconsistent with Oregon's existing laws that, one, the operator maintain proper lookout, and two, continuously observe a water skier. And despite the testimony of the proponents, we've witnessed this phenomena with personal watercraft where the operators of those craft, and we believe the operators of these craft as well, get a phenomenon known as tunnel vision. And what's happening is they're concentrating in this case on the water skiing activity and where the device is tracking, but fundamentally they can't be maintaining proper lookout in all directions. They tend to be focused on what they're doing. We've seen a number of accidents involving personal watercraft resulting from this, and we anticipate the same is going to happen with this type of craft if they become as popular as the proponents have led us to believe. If sales projections are correct, we could be looking at 1,400 of these units in the next couple of years. We think it's prudent to establish safety zones in advance of that, to try to be proactive as opposed to reactive with this. And we would feel that there's a need to establish a number of these zones so that we don't bunch up the use, and so that people living in different parts of the state have access to those zones as well. So those are some of the reasons that we have put together the fiscal impact statement that we have.
If I could, I'd like to ask a question on the statement you provided by office yesterday, along with the cover letter, raises the orange gear down flag you indicated that it doesn't exist on this facility. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there's no requirement in this bill. This bill would exempt them from the requirements for a skier down flat.
Well, the bill, as Mr. Hughes said, requires them to meet all obligations issued by the State Marine Bill. Is that correct in the bill? On page 1 of the bill?
9.10.3.
If you'll turn to page 2 of the bill and look at line 6, or actually lines 1 through 6, this is where there's a requirement for the skier down flag. And by amending subsection C, it indicates that the flag described in the subsection shall be described only under conditions set forth in B. In paragraph B, we're talking about a person in the boat displaying that flag. So, as I read it, it effectively precludes that. There's no requirement. This device may have that, but there's nothing saying that this is the only device that will come along that might try to use this exemption.
But the way it's written, the way I read it is that you wouldn't have to have an observer on the boat raising the flag. The flag could automatically raise itself, and it would meet the requirements of the statute. So, Mr. Hughes or your associate, would you like to come forward? Have both of you sitting here. What is your definition of what you're trying to achieve here? Wouldn't the safety flag be raised regardless if a person fell on their skis and went into the water? The safety flag would activate upon the engine shutting down?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Immediately upon the release of the tow handle, the down skier flag automatically raises up to a very high level, so it's very visible. The flag is always visible on the boat, but when the skier does fall, it automatically pops up about another 5 feet in the air.
Mr. Donner, is the issue of 40 other states doing this. What is the Marine Board doing in those other states, particularly California, Washington, Idaho, that we're not doing?
Mr. Chairman, the best information I have from the National Association of State Boating Law Administrators in their most recent edition of the State Boating Laws synopsis indicated that at least a third of the states do not currently allow these self-propelled water skis. So I don't know where the number 40 or whatever comes up with. But the fact is that these devices have not been on the market for the past 10 or 20 years. Some states do not require an observer. And therefore, in those states that do not require an observer, these devices would be permitted. They're not permitted consciously, if you will, or explicitly permitted. They're permitted by default in the fact that some states don't require an observer.
Well, even if 30% of the states, that only translates to 15 states. Now, there's 50 the last time I checked. There's 30%?
16 states specifically prohibit these.
16 states, okay. That's one off. 16 states specifically prohibit this, and the rest of them approve of it?
The rest of them either approve of it or are silent on the question of an observer, and therefore, by default, they would be allowed. The fact is that they're not currently in wide production or in wide use, and so many states haven't addressed this issue.
I guess my concern comes from a public safety standpoint on the waterway and the observer issue. I'm interested to know if the Marine Board can tell me the amount of water ski accidents that happen in those states that currently don't have observer laws like we do here in Oregon. Is there a higher incidence of water ski accidents, water skiers being run over, or any of those kinds of things? Because I think that that's the most compelling piece. I think the flag raising up and those things, I mean, this is a novel and innovative concept, but, you know, if there's truly a public safety concern, then obviously there should be evidence in those other states with no observers, because that's my concern, is more the peripheral view as these people are skiing along, what they can see and what goes on a busy lake or even in the early morning on a lake, what they can see. And I'm just interested if you have any of those statistics, because that's the public safety concern that concerns me. If there's not a higher incidence in these other states that don't have, that don't have observers, then really I don't see a lot of difference.
Chairman, Representative Butler, I don't have the statistics with me this morning. I'd be happy to provide them, but there is a difference. And in Oregon, that was the reason that we passed the skier observer law about 8 years ago, was the fact that we were seeing an increase in the number of accidents involving people without skiers, and that fundamentally there's a conflict between the two laws that we had. One law saying that the operator has to maintain proper lookout, and the second, when we had the curved mirror requirement, was that the operator continuously observe the skier. And there's a conflict between those two. You can't continuously observe the skier and maintain proper lookout at the same time. That's one of the reasons that the American Water Ski Association endorsed our bill to require an observer, and that's an association of professional skiing groups, and they endorsed the skier down or the skier observer and skier flag requirement.
Follow-up question?
Yes.
Then has the number of incidences where accidents have occurred decreased in Oregon over the last 8 years in regards to water skiers as a result of the observer law?
I think we have made progress in that regard, yes.
Yes. I don't feel like I got the information to make a decision, but...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I wanted to comment on the still water issue and how it might affect safety. It doesn't seem to me that it would really affect safety, since if the water is not still, this isn't going to operate. That's the testimony I heard. That it requires for the water to be still to operate. So you don't have a safety issue there, because we don't have any skier going around the lake or whatever body of water, because the engine won't work. And as far as the observer, although you said that you're concerned about the tunnel vision sort of effect, it seems to me that the ultimate observer is the skier and has control. So they are the observer and would be most cautious, of their own bodily harm. And would, I think, in some ways, be more in jeopardy if somebody else operating the boat.
Chairman, Senator Cusup, the issue of flat water, while this device is being marketed for water skiing, it's also capable of pulling people in inner tubes, tubing-type devices, where cavitation and the temporary loss of power is less an issue, as I would see it, because if you temporarily slow down in those kinds of situations, you're not going to fall off your water ski. So I could envision these things being used on our more popular lakes and rivers in conditions where there is some wave and wake chop, because if you're pulling tubers behind it, that's not so much an issue. Moreover, it's as we've seen with personal watercraft, it's often not the owner operator that is the problem in terms of accidents, but the five or six friends that they bring along with them to the beach that they say, gee, it looks like fun, can I try it? And so you suddenly have inexperienced people jumping behind these things, and with the personal watercraft, as with these, I would expect we'd see those kinds of accidents and incidents.
Okay, further questions or comments? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 1296?
Mr. Chair, may I make an additional comment?
Yes.
Thank you. I'd like to address Representative Patton's question. The original company produced and shipped into the marketplace about 1,000 of the original units, of which there's about 750 still in use to this day that have been in the marketplace for the last 10 years. Most of those units are spread up in Southern California, and in there's a few up in Washington, a lot in Florida, and a number in the Great Lakes states. But the vast majority is spread out between Southern California and Florida. And there has never been an accident or insurance claim on one of the original units, even as antiquated as they were. Again, I really feel that I need to stress that
the type of people that are predominantly using it, and you're right, we certainly can't control the guy that's taking his friends out and wants to try it. But the vast majority of our marketing feasibility shows that the users that are going to be predominantly using this craft are very safety conscious individuals who've been around boating safety since they were very, very small.
Okay. Is there further questions? Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I just, while Robin is testifying, I'd just like to have him tell us what level of choppiness the water could be before the engine does begin to cut out. What wake level, what wave level, the wind blows in some parts of Oregon, you're going to have some of that. Can you give us some feel for that?
Yes, I can, Mr. Chair. Representative Butler, from my own experience in skiing behind this, I'm an avid water skier. I don't like to ski on anything much over a ripple, and that's pushing it for me. However, as far as the craft being operational, it will operate up to about 4 inches adequately. And I'm stressing that at this point. Once you start getting into cuts and chops that is over 4 inches, every time that pump pops out of the water and the cavitation is created, you have a resulting loss of power. And for a skier or a wakeboarder, people that are using these even for this to go out to train and to prepare, it's just simply not adequate.
Okay, are there further questions? Well, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1296. Open the work session on Senate Bill 1296. Senator Q-Tub now moves Senate Bill 1296 to the Full Ways and Means Committee with a D-Pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Representative Butler.
I would just like to ask Ms. Jordan relative to the fiscal year. If we're passing this to the full with a D-Pass recommendation, this is just an estimate of the fiscal impact and any kind of licensing, those kinds of things would have to be by the ruling within the agency, it has to be an administrative rule to charge a license fee, and then it has to come back to the emergency board to charge a license fee for an additional license fee if they felt that was necessary, or to hire on, obviously, as indicated, it wouldn't be appropriate to move to half-staff position just because
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, a couple of things. The amount of time that it takes is only an estimate, and to develop a study for the safety requirements and administrative rules is at best probably a temporary situation and not permanent. And depending upon how they implement the program and whether they designate certain areas to start out with, like they do in other lakes or waterways in Oregon, they have certain lakes you can ski on and certain ones you cannot, would depend on how much they would need for their capital at the buoys that they would have to place. And so, therefore, it would be more appropriate for them to come back to the emergency board with a fine-tuned estimate. Some of the costs that they presented are costs that they already incur as a result of their other programs, and I wouldn't recommend those. And they could absorb these costs along with their other programs. It would mean that they would have to shift other priorities or projects that they might have done during the biennium, but they could still absorb the costs within their existing
follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Not being familiar totally with the administrative rule process and how this whole process works, what I need to know is that 40 other states permit these, and 16 of those states have written specific regulations. Don't we would look, and there's been evidence of a national organization of boating state boating programs. Wouldn't we normally take from the existing statutes and take a look at those in other states that specifically permit these?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, they would, that would be part of their process, the public process. They have to take public testimony, and they would use their expertise and show it to the Oregon.
All right. So what the laws that are already written and provided for you? Okay, thank you.
Okay. say you've heard the motion. Is there further discussion? Not the clerk will call the roll.
Hanson?
Aye.
Lynn?
No.
Lynn?
Aye.
Beth?
No.
Schrader?
Aye.
Gottlieb?
Aye.
Patrick?
No.
John?
Aye.
Karen?
Aye. The motion carries. You need to carry me for that. Senator Kidd has been on.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen.